Blog Talk Radio.
If horror makes you happy and spooky stories stimulate your soul, then you've found the House of Usher of podcasts. Seize your blanket and get ready to leave the lights on. It's time for Scary Scribes.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Scary Scribes, Episode 13. I'm your host, Christy Peterson-Schoonover, ghost story writer and author of the Pushcart-nominated Bad Apple. Tonight is our final show. I know this comes as a shock to many people, but while I have really enjoyed my experience with Scary Scribes, I've been doing so many projects lately that I decided that 2013 was the year I was going to get back into concentrating heavily on my writing and on my reading, which are the two things I love to do most, well, besides swim, and I have gone back to the pool on a regular basis as well. You will still, however, be able to hear all of our episodes at any time on the Scary Scribes website, which is www.scaryscribes.com, and also at my personal website, which is www.christypetersonschoonover.com. And even if you Google that and butcher it, I'm pretty much, as far as I know, the only one there is, so chances are you'll find me. I'm also by myself on the board tonight, again, and with Nathan and Sean getting ready for the Ghost Man and Demon Hunter show around here. It's a little bit crazy in my house. Their guest tonight, by the way, is going to be Eddie Munster, and you can tune in live to that at 7 p.m. at www.ghostanddemon.com. So what that means is I'm going to do my best with the background noise, but you may hear some as I've been relegated to my dining room. So it's kind of a high-traffic area, but I think we'll be fine. On a final sad note, I am sorry to report that Daniel Perlman, my mentor and friend of 20 years, and a fine writer of fantastical fiction, passed away on Monday. Dan was on our show in May, and it was his first radio interview in 40 years. So we were quite honored to have him. I and everyone who knew him will miss him dearly. He was an incredible writer. He was an amazing teacher. And he was a loving friend. But he will live on through his words, and that's the great thing about being a writer. You live on. If you'd like to look at any of his work or buy some, you can visit the Scary Scribes website and go to the Guest Links and Books page and go to Daniel Perlman, and there's links there to everything you need to find. And if you'd like to go back and listen to Dan's show, on which I read from his latest and final published collection, A Giant in the House and Other Excesses, you can do that on our website there as well. Once again, it was the May episode, May 27th, 2012. And now that the business is out of the way, I am honored to introduce our guest tonight, J.S. Watts, who is joining us all the way from England. And as the sun sets on Scary Scribes, we'll get a chance to hear some of her new dark fantasy from Vagabondage Press Books, A Darker Moon, a mythical tale of light and shadow and the unlit places where it is best not to shine even the dimmest light. I'll read from her work and then stick around because we'll be talking with her. And now, some of A Darker Moon. A small brown owl perches on my cot rail, its huge yellow eyes like two full harvest moons. It may only be a little owl, but those eyes are big enough to drown an infant, and I have a sense of falling, of being sucked in and down towards two pools of deep moonlight. It is my earliest memory. It is followed very closely, within the variable flow of remembered time, by another in which an elderly woman, whom retrospectively I have assumed to be one of my many carers, taps my lips with an ungentle finger and mutters unintelligible mantras. Unintelligible, that is, except for one word, Lilith. That word and the two luminous drowning pools imprinted themselves on my consciousness and haunted me into adulthood. Even now, I sometimes wake with a start from a dream in which I am forever falling to hear the fading hiss of a whispered Lilith, convinced I have been listening to mumbled septuagenarian incantations in my sleep. As for owls, they have a morbid fascination for me, but I couldn't bear to live within the sound of their call. I think it is fair to say that I did not have a settled childhood, and most of my different carers and foster homes have become something of an amorphous blur in the mental album of my recollections. In addition to the early memories, the only other strong image I have from this first period of my life is of my mother, or rather, of the one and only photograph that I have of her. I do not actually remember my mother. When she abandoned me in a basket on the steps of a North London synagogue, the only things she left me with were barely enough blankets, my first name, written on the back of an address card of a less than reputable Soho nightclub of the time, and a black and white photograph of herself. At least everyone, including me, has always assumed that it is a photograph of her. There is no name or inscription on the photo, or any other indication as to whom it is. But why would you leave a photograph of just anyone with an abandoned baby? It must be my mother. It has to be her. In the photograph, she is standing, partially side on to the camera, with her face turned to look at the photographer. She holds her hands behind her back, and in them is something dark. It is not clear what. A clutch bag or a book, maybe? Perhaps she was studious. Her hair is long, black, and gently wavy. She is wearing it loose and slightly unkempt. Her dark eyes stare directly at the camera, her face unsmiling, but not stern. More quietly confident, mildly challenging, maybe a trifle arrogant. Wearing a long, baggy dress in beads, a feather boa draped around her neck, and with her tousled hair, she looks like a hippie, a 60s love child. Sometimes, I wonder if I was the real love child, a freebie that came with the free love of the era, an unexpected and unasked-for acquisition that she felt equally free to give away and pass on without compunction or guilt. On days when I am feeling somewhat more generous towards her, I wonder if she was a working girl, hence the nightclub card, who fell on hard times and gave me up, with tears and regrets, in order to give me a better life than she could offer. Who knows? I certainly don't. But at least I have the freedom to create stories that shine a little light on the gloomier and more uncertain parts of my life. Of my father, I know even less. No name, no photograph, no nothing. My hair and eye color are dark like the woman's in the photograph. Does that mean my father was equally dark, or just that my mother's were the stronger genes of the two? The fact that I know nothing of my father does not bother me. The little information I have about my mother, as constructed from her possible photograph, gnaws away at me, but over the years I have had to learn to deal with the bite marks. Yet another unknown aspect of my heritage is my faith. Am I Jewish? My mother had dark hair and eyes and abandoned me at a synagogue. Little enough to go on, but it might indicate a Hebrew legacy, mightn't it? I, too, am dark-haired and dark-eyed, and my name is Old Testament Kosher, though I am not circumcised. This gave the rabbi who found me, like a landlocked Latter-day Moses, something of a dilemma. Should he hand over full responsibility for me to the secular authorities, or ensure I was brought up as one of the chosen people? It would have been nice to have been chosen. My maybe mother looked as if she might have been Jewish, which should have counted for something, but there was no way of telling. I had been found on a Friday, just at sunset, So the rabbi kept me for the Sabbath and then handed me over, lock, stock, and blankets, to social services as soon as possible the following Monday morning. And I do mean as soon as possible. One of my old social workers told me he was standing on the department steps with me and the basket thrust down at his feet well before anyone had arrived at the office to open up. From this inauspicious start in life, I entered the state care system as a doubly rejected child of unknown parentage and indeterminate faith, which only a set of poor quality blankets, an anonymous photograph, and a card from the disreputable Black Moon Club to my name. I have other memories, some quite vivid. Those that I can place chronologically, I have built into the story of my childhood. That will come later. But there are memories I cannot locate in time, cannot anchor to a there or then, or anything that flows with the current of my story. Bastard. Got no mummy. Got no daddy. You're a bastard. Bar. Stud. I'm not. No mummy. No daddy. Bastard. Bastard. I've got a mummy. I've got a mummy. I have. I had. I have. Then there was the cat. She was little more than a kitten, really. Silky black fur, a white line down her nose, little white paws, and she was mine. She adopted me. She took titbits from my fingers and purred when I came near. Then I heard him. Evie, Evie, come here, Evie. She won't come to you. Yes, she will. Evie, come here, Evie. She won't come to you. She's mine, and she's not called Evie. She's not yours. She's not anybody's, and if I want to call her Evie, I can. Can't. Can. Can't. What do you call her? I don't. Then I can call her what I like. Evie, come here, Evie. And she came to him. She took food from out of his hand, and she purred. I never fed her after that. If she came after me, I threw stones at her. Some hit her. She yowled. She never bothered me again. I can also remember books, rows and rows of them, stacks, a library, old and dusty. Were they mine? No one else seemed interested in them, so they can't have been very valuable. I can't remember what was in them, what they were about. What was the value of them? Only what I remember. And finally, candles. Rows and rows of them, too. Lighting the way down the steps. Steep, made of stone, going all the way down into the blackness at the bottom. Dark, moist, waiting. You dream of candles. You're weird. No, I'm not, I said. Weird boy, weird boy. I'm not weird, I said. It's only a dream. Everybody dreams. Weird boy, weirdy boy, beardy boy, bastard. Got no mummy nor no daddy, bastard, barst, ood. I'm not, I said. I've got a mummy. I have, I have. I've seen her picture. She's mine. And that was the first little bit of J.S. Watts's A Darker Moon, a paranormal novel from Vagabondage Press Books. And I am on the line with J.S. Watts right now. Hello, are you still there?
Hello, Chrissy. I'm still here.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good. You're calling, I know, all the way from England. So it's like late there, isn't it? Like late.
It's late. It's well gone 11 o'clock at night here, so it's all rather dark and gloomy.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. You know, your book is amazing. I'm so glad that I got a chance to share it on the show. But before I, you know, let JS tell us all about herself and her work, I'd like to introduce her a little bit and note that her poetry, short stories, and book reviews appear in a wide variety of publications in Britain, Canada, Australia, and the States, including Acumen, Envoy, Flexia, and Orbis. Her work has also been broadcast on the BBC and independent radio. JS has been Poetry Reviews editor for Open Wide magazine and poetry editor for Ethereal Tales. Her published poetry collections include Cats and Other Myths and Songs of Steelyard Sue. Songs of Steelyard Sue, sorry. So welcome to the show. And why don't you tell us a little bit about, because it seems like you did, I can clearly see, I mean, the language is beautiful. I can clearly see that you do definitely, you were a poet. Were you a poet first? I mean, a poet you never are, you know, you never are formerly a poet, but did you start with poetry? How did you enter the world of writing?
Right, depends how far back in time you want to go. Certainly kind of as a youngster I wrote poetry, I wrote short stories. I suppose in adulthood, yes, the poetry came first, because it's probably often quite, it's easier to write poetry. You can do it in small snatches whilst working. So I used to write a lot of poetry, and I like the tightness, the precision of language that poetry gives you. But I've always kind of dabble with short stories as well. And I first got published in terms of poetry, again, published by literary magazines and the like. And my first poetry collection came out in 2011. But I always kind of hoped I had a novel in me, shall we say. So, yeah, apparently I have.
Yes, no, it's really interesting. What I really like about this opening is that, first of all, it really felt to me like the classic unreliable narrator, you know, Poe's unreliable narrator, where we have that first person. And it has been said that sustaining an entire novel in the first person is difficult. Of course, I disagree with that because I, of course, my novel's all in the first person, too. Did you have any issues with that? Where did this all come from in terms of the I? Like, how important was that? Like, could you have, I guess what I'm asking is, could you have told this story in third person, in a different point of view? Would it have worked? Or did it really need to be I?
Right. Well, I think it needs to be I, because I kind of wrote it that way. But you're right. I mean, the whole point is that the Abe, the anti-hero, for want of a better term, is perhaps not the most reliable narrator out there, and to me it felt it had to be written in his voice. The story came to me in his voice.
Right.
As I shared earlier drafts of the novel with various people, I did get the, you can't write it in first person, it's not going to work, you can't sustain it, what are you doing that, put it in third person. But I heard it in his voice, so for me it could only be in first person, because of who Abe is, where he's coming from, where he ends up, it really had to be in his voice because you had to hear what he had to say, and indeed you had to notice when he didn't say things and the gaps he left behind him in his tale. So first person it was, definitely.
No, I would definitely have to agree because I wanted to hear what you said, but I too have run into that where it's like, oh, you can't do it in first person, and I really do disagree. I think that some stories come to you that way, and that's because that's the way they want to talk.
Absolutely.
I know. Absolutely. I'm making it sound a little creepy, like they have minds of their own, yeah. But they kind of do.
No, they do, you're quite right. So I've written a second novel still at the drafting editing stage, and that came to me in third person, and that was right, and that was how that story wanted to be told. But this one very much has to be told in the narrator's voice. And I find that with short stories as well. Some you write in first person, some you write in third. But if you can relate to your story, it tells you how it needs to be written. You're right, that does sound creepy, but that's how it is.
Yeah, the other thing that I find very interesting is one of the themes that runs through this novel. And I do think that it's a theme that plays a key role in how things pan out, so I kind of wanted your comment on it, is this idea of identity. the lack of identity. Or so can you elaborate or just talk about that a little bit? Was it something you did on purpose? Did you not figure it out till later? I just wanted to tap your brain about that.
Yeah, no, it was one of the key themes. I think it developed as I wrote it, like lots of stories and novels. I had the idea, I had the themes that I wanted to play around with, and some of them developed and kind of took on more of a life of their own. Some of them perhaps faded into the background. But certainly the idea of identity and linked to it, the idea of memory and
yeah.
how memory plays with identity and whether it influences who we are, who we've been, who we think of ourselves, was a key theme and one of the main drivers of the story for me.
Yeah, and I certainly, that was my next thing that I had written in my notes was about memory. And that said, you know, had this character, let's say, if this character knew that this was his mother, for sure, how would that have changed the way that he behaved in the book or the way that he behaved given the circumstances? I mean, I think there's a lot to be said for, you know, nature versus nurture. Are we really a product of how we're born and where we come from?
Well, again, I don't think I, when writing it, I was conscious of the nature versus nurture debate specifically for the novel, although it's a concept that has always fascinated me. So it wasn't surprising that, again, that found itself in the novel, that how much is AIDS uncertainty of who he is, how much is his uncertainty of what he can remember, how much is it that, you know, it's what he's becoming, it's what he is that's driving him. So it's a theme that's always fascinated me for a number of reasons, but I think it certainly developed more as the story came along. But it's very much, it is what he remembers or doesn't remember, are his experiences, the nurture part driving him, or is there a fundamental nature which he hasn't yet recognized that controls his destiny and his fate?
Yeah, and I also think, too, what's very interesting is that, of course, the owl is a prominent symbol in the book, especially in the beginning, but it kind of, you know, it carries throughout. And another motif that I noticed is this idea of eyes, the idea of eyes being the windows to the soul. I think it's interesting that you chose an owl. I think you could have probably chosen other animals. I mean, I don't want to give it away too much because I want the readers to go out and get this book and read it because it's a wonderful book. So I don't want to, like, go blowing it and give a bunch of spoilers. But I just found it fascinating that the owl was the symbol of choice, because the owl we always think of as wise and full of knowledge and knows all. And yet here is this character, especially in the beginning, who knows nothing.
That's one of the main drivers for the image of the owl. It is kind of the image of wisdom, of knowledge, but that's exactly what he's lacking. But maybe he finds wisdom, or indeed maybe he doesn't. So that was one of the reasons for picking the owl. As you say, it's not just the owl, that there's kind of the issue of eyes, whether it starts off with eye colour, whether it's characters looking into one another's eyes later as we go along. And, of course, with an owl, with those huge saucer eyes, which are what we see in the opening chapter, that was also another driver. And without giving too much of the game away, the owl is a symbol of one of the mythological characters who features quite heavily in the book. So put all that together,
right,
it kind of had to be an owl, I think.
Now, let's get back a little bit to, I think there's always one nugget. As a writer myself, I think I can definitely say there's one moment where a story comes to you or you get the idea for a story. Where did this come from?
I'm not sure I always agree with the one nugget theory. If I look at a lot of my writing, whether it's the book or stories or poems, I often find that what influences me are the coming together of things. Okay, yes, there is a focal point. I suppose that's the nugget where the things come together. And for me, as I said, there's been always an interest in nature versus nurture. I've always had a fascination with the mythological. I grew up reading books on kind of myths and legends of the world. So the tales that we tell as part of our various religions have always influenced me. The issue of memory and how much that drives us. Issues of mental health. I do actually work, voluntary work with a psychiatric hospital. So that's a theme as well. And then finally, just being mindful of how I put it so I don't give the game away too much, was what happens when you find that the person you've been really close to, indeed physically close to you, as in terms of sexual congress, what happens when you discover that person isn't who you thought they were? And how do you deal with that?
Yeah.
Particularly if the discovery is fairly traumatic. And put all those together, that for me is the focal point of where the story kind of spiraled out from.
Well, and I think, too, what you're saying about what happens when the person that you really were closest to or adored or whatever, you find out they were exactly not what you thought they were or who he thought he was or she was.
Mm.
I think that's a very universal theme. I mean, it's a very universal. I think everyone, no matter where you've been in your life, I think everyone can identify with that. It's almost like a betrayal, but you often wonder if it's just because you didn't see it type of thing, or
yes.
Did you want to see it, you know?
Yes, precisely. It's, again, that ambivalence, which, again, is another theme for me that runs throughout the novel. Were you betrayed by that person? Did they hide their true selves from you? Or did you not see it? Did you fail to see it? Did you kind of block it out and deny it? So, yeah, have you been betrayed or have you betrayed yourself? That uncertainty is an interesting position to be in.
Very, very interesting. I mean, that was one of the things that really spoke to me. Just because I've been through that situation a couple of times, and they were both very traumatic, and I was like, oh, my God, I totally get it. Like, this is awesome, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that anyone who has been there will definitely enjoy that. What was the hardest part of putting this together for you? Was it story? Was it the process of working with the publisher? Was it – I'm not saying be negative. I'm just saying what was your biggest challenge – in getting this out of your head to on the bookshelves?
Gosh.
I know, because there's like a million, right?
Yeah. No, it certainly wasn't the publisher, because the publisher was brilliant.
Yep.
And I must admit, okay, I've been an editor myself, and I was kind of dreading the editing process, because when people start to challenge what you're writing, it's like, did you really mean that? And why did you write that? But no, brilliant editor, can't fault them. And yeah, you get the first manuscript through the editorial comments, you go, ooh, suck teeth, wince, and actually, no, they're quite right. So editing process was far, far better than I was expecting, and I take my hat off to the publisher on that. I tell you what the most difficult part was. I think it was in the early stages of writing the novel.
Mm-hmm.
I'd got the bare outline of the story, and I'd started writing, and it was flat. I'm trying to think how to describe it. When I write poetry, sometimes, you know, a poem comes into its own, it starts to breathe of its own volition, it inflates.
Mm-hmm.
We're back into creepy stuff here. And the same with stories. And I'd written a story, and it meant a lot, and I looked at the first draft, probably the first half of the novel, and it was flat, and it wasn't breathing. And I thought, but this is a story I want to write, and yet there was no air in the lungs of the story. And I spent some time thinking, well, what is it? Why is it flat? What do I need to get the story breathing, to get the novel breathing? And there were a few months there, I'm thinking, okay, all the right bits are in the right places, but my creature does not have life. And then, I don't know, you play around, you think, oh, maybe I should draw that theme out, I should do more of this. And I like to think the creature started breathing, but there was a moment there when I thought, you know, maybe my Frankenstein sponsor is not going to be able to walk on its own, but I like to think it did in the end.
Yeah, oh, no. I mean, this book absolutely breathes you know, and if I can just clarify that a little bit for our listeners out there, what she means when she says flat or breathing, I can tell from my own experience, because I agree with her, that is often where I have the biggest problem with my work, is that you're dying to write the story, you want to get it out of you, you're really enamored with it, it's haunting you night and day, and you sit down and you start actually trying to put it into words, and there is an element of it that's just stilted, or it doesn't work right, or you can't get sucked into the flow of it. I think, I don't know, would you agree with me? I think that's the best way I could kind of clarify that.
Yeah, I think that's good. I mean, obviously from a writer's point of view, it, because you're so close to what you're creating, it does feel like kind of breathing life into to your own creation, your own Frankenstein's monster. But I think you're right. It is that bit where you can't identify what's out of place, what's out of kilter with it, but you know you've got something that is a flat, deflated balloon rather than a big, bouncy one.
Right, right. And I think, too, if you're really into the process of creating a draft, like this, I mean, the writing in this is incredible because it flows, it spills one thing into another. It's very smooth, and I'm not just talking about the technical aspects like the writing style and the sentences and all that stuff. I'm not even talking about that. I'm talking about the story really does breathe. It has a life of its own, and it carries you with it when you read it. And achieving that is so difficult to do, particularly with good writing. You know, I mean, let's face it, there's a lot of garbage out there. And a lot of the times the garbage is what everybody ends up reading because that's what people are pushing. And it's not necessarily good writing. It's stilted or it's got big holes in it or it doesn't. And this book is just beautiful because you start, you're sucked in right away and you're along for the ride. And then the book just seems to take you with it. And I think when people ask me what makes good writing, that's what I always say. I say, if I can disappear into this thing and go along for the ride, that's good writing. And I think there's a lot out there that doesn't do that. So, but anyway.
I'd agree with you. I'm kind of an avid reader. I want to lose myself in a book. I want to pick it up, forget I'm in a book, get immersed in the story, get carried along, and not be conscious of the writing, however beautiful it is, not be conscious of the room I'm sitting in, really. I want to be there in the story. And it's really rather nice to hear you say you think I've done it. So thank you.
Yes, no, definitely. It was, for me, this book was a straight read. I picked it up and I just literally, it was a railroad to the end. I could not put it down. That's rare with me. I don't always get that, particularly with a novel, because I am a short story writer. I had one novel in me. That's great. I'm telling you right now, it's probably the only novel that's ever going to come out of me. Maybe. Well, there's another one laying in a drawer that I'm going to work on. But again, it, like you, it's got issues and it's flat. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, it's just going to lay there for a while. But there was a book I did that with recently. And the writing itself was not fantastic. But the story just lived and breathed. And I think in some ways, and you're a poet, because I honestly think poetry is very difficult. I mean, earlier on you said poetry is very easy for me because you can do it in little bits, but I think poetry is the shortest form, and I honestly think it's the most difficult thing to do because you don't have a whole novel to, like, explain everything. You just got to say what you have to say in the fewest words.
I was going to say, it is a very intense process, and I can't remember who it was, but someone said poetry is the right words in the right order and nothing else. Every word has to count. But that's a good mechanism for writing, to really focus yourself down. But
now, this book, this story has quite a few, you know, obviously it's a mystical story. It's a paranormal story. It's a little bit of a fantastical story. Where did all of those elements come from in your life? You had said you'd always had a fascination with the myths, you know, and reading growing up, et cetera, et cetera. Can you talk a little bit more about that connection and how that comes out in the work?
Yeah, surely. As to why I'm fascinated with myths and legends, I'm not totally sure. I suppose I can probably blame my mother. Both my father and mother were kind of, well, they told me stories as a kid. I liked being told stories, so Mum made up stories about the fairy mustard seed and all her fairy chums. So I suppose there's an element of fantasy there. I can remember my father making up a song, which he later came to regret, about the mermaid with the rusty tail, because she'd sat for too long with her tail in a bucket of water and it had got rusty. And as a child, all I wanted was, tell me the story about the mermaid with the rusty tail. As my father had done it as one off and couldn't remember what it was, I think he got a bit bored with trying to reinvent it. But anyway, so they were fantastical tales from a very early age. Certainly once I was allowed loose in our public libraries, as I said, books I used to get out over and over again were tales of myths and legends. Why they fascinated me at that age, I don't know, but they did. And then, wasn't very old when I discovered things like Tolkien and The Hobbit, and then later Lord of the Rings. In fact, I can remember coming back from school. I think I'd been allowed into the junior school library. Junior school in the UK is between age 7 and 11, so I'd probably just turned 7. And I'd got The Hobbit off the shelf, and it was a little bit too difficult for me to read, but I insisted my mother read The Hobbit to me over and over and over again. So that there's always been that love of the fantastical. I mean, as I've got older, and as a writer, I've justified my interest in myth and legend and fantasy, because basically fantasy is something you create from scratch. You've got that blank page to write whatever you want to write, so it's a great freedom for a writer. But it also, to my mind, I suppose as a human species, we put ourselves into our fantasy. The myths we make up, whether they're religious myths or fairy stories, they enshrine our own hopes and fears and anxieties. So you find humanity in our own myths and legends. But that's something I've kind of thought about as I've grown older and become an adult. Why I liked it as a child, I don't know. It just resonated. So I guess with all that background and all the knowledge of fantasy and tales, it was not surprising that a particular set of fantasies and myths worked their way into the story. Why this one in particular? I guess it's got things like the issue of opposites. Obviously, a story where you've got two brothers involved. I don't think I'm giving the game away there. You've got that opportunity to play with opposites, and as you get with siblings, it's the issue of identity, which we mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
So it seemed like a good myth to explore some of my interests about human psyche and what makes us tick.
Yeah. No, I'd have to agree. I think many of the stories that we tell, you know, like you said, we put ourselves in them. I mean, a darker moon, to me, in one way, is a quest story. And I'm not talking about structure or anything like that, you know, how they say the mythical quest and the hero does this and all that. I'm not talking about that. I'm just saying in one way it is a quest story. It is a quest to find the self. It is a quest to find that sense of identity. It's a quest to remember. It's a quest for a lot, for many things. And I think in myths and legends and stories, you know, in horror stories, why do we have the same tropes coming up over and over? It's because I think we as humans are always trying to figure things out.
Yes, and we've got the same drivers, the same anxieties, the same questions that always need to be asked and answered or attempted to be answered. So I would go with that. I'm a great fan of the kind of critic Marina Warner and her view on things like fairy tales and myths and why the same tropes and the same themes come up. I guess it's not surprising that a lot of those find their way into A Darker Moon.
What has been your biggest surprise so far? Like in your, I don't want to necessarily say with the process of this particular book, but in your career in general, what has been your biggest pleasant surprise? What's been your biggest surprise that you weren't too happy about? I don't know. I always find that an interesting question to ask people. And now you're going to go, oh, my God, I don't even know what she's asking me.
That's right. It's an extremely difficult one to answer. It's kind of covered the whole of my life for just the writing part of it. Ooh, duh. I don't know what sort of... I don't think I've had that many surprises. I suppose the most recent surprise, if you can call it a surprise, was the relief at finding I did have a novel in me. As I said, I've read since the year dot and been a great and avid reader. I've written since, almost since I can remember, and always wanted to write. I always had this feeling of, could I have a novel in me? And said, well, I've been writing poetry and publishing it, which is wonderful. There was this feeling of, if I had the time, could I sit down and produce a novel? Would it be there? Would it be real? I suppose the discovery that, yes, I produced one, which I'm quite proud of, and it's been published, and said that there are others in the pipeline yet to see the light of day, but I'm writing them as well. So discovered that, yes, yeah, I suppose that is, it's a pleasant surprise. I do have a novel in me. Indeed, I have a couple more coming along. As for negative surprises, can I pass on that one? Am I allowed to pass on those sort of questions? Because I can't think of anything that's been a negative surprise.
Yeah, I know that for me, in my own career, I've had loads of positive surprises. Mm-hmm. I think one of my negative surprises, just to give you an idea, was how much promoting we have to do. I'm always everywhere. Like, can't I just shut up and write and be quiet, and can't it just come to me? Like,
I was going to agree with you, there's an awful lot of promotion to be done. I don't think it was a surprise to me. Perhaps it was because I've been writing poetry for a long time and have been sort of getting published since the 1990s that right. I was aware that you had to promote. And certainly before I took the plunge and wrote full time, so while I was writing the poems and holding down the day job, I was conscious that I couldn't do the promotion that the writing needed. So you're right, there's an awful lot of it, but it wasn't a surprise. I guess, trying to look for a surprise, the thing that hit me the first and still hits me years down the line, the volume of rejections you get. I know when I first started writing, people said, oh, you be prepared to paper your downstairs loo or the lounge with the rejections. But it isn't until you actually see the volume mounting up and you think, good grief, are they all my rejections? And that I think, yeah, that probably was a surprise. It continues to be a surprise because you can't kind of believe quite so many rejections in the world, really. But, hey, they're all in that box down there.
Yes. Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. And I run a magazine called Read Short Fiction, and we've just gone over to paying professional rates. And we've been in business for 3 or 4 years now. And my partner is a very dear friend of mine, and he never wants to send out the rejection letters. He's always like, can you do it? Can you do it? And, you know, of course I always do it, and I can't say that I don't feel bad, because I do. I feel bad rejecting every single writer. But being a writer myself and knowing how many you get, and they still shock you. I don't care what anybody says. Like, every once in a while, I'm just like, really? Like, you know, it's like, but I think that's part of the joy of it. It's so hard to get past that because it's your art. You know, it's not like you got turned down for a date or a job or something like that. It's like, it's your art. Like, you poured your soul into this, and that's, I think, what makes it hard.
It is, because because what you do is you, what you write is you, therefore it's personal. Any rejection, even if it's, I've been an editor myself, so I've done the rejecting as well, and you know, well, actually it's a perfectly good poem or a perfectly good short story, but it doesn't quite fit the magazine or indeed the particular edition of the magazine you're trying to put together. It might have fitted the one before, it might fit the one two editions down the line, but it doesn't fit the one you're looking for. so you have to say no. But from on the receiving end, they're rejecting you, whether it's because they think you're not very good or whether they think you're just not the right fit. But it hurts. It does hurt. I don't think you ever quite come to terms with that. Yeah, even when you think, well, hey, I'm published, it's okay. No, it's not okay.
Yeah.
It's really upsetting. There you go.
Yeah, and I do feel that in most cases, that's 95% of the rejection. It's not a good fit. Or you caught the editor on a bad day. You know, my professor, the mentor who had just passed away, one of the most profound pieces of advice he gave me was back in 1993. And he said to me, okay, somebody, you just sent a story to a magazine, and in it, there's a dog, and the dog dies a violent, terrible, bloody death. You submit this story not knowing that the editor at the other end of the mailbox, because, of course, back then you still sent it all in on paper. You know, there wasn't this email stuff back in the 90s, early 90s.
Tell me about it. I remember it well.
Totally. And guess what? Their dog just died yesterday. He goes, for all you know, your story just hit that person at a bad time. He said, that's one reason. Another reason is it's just not a match or somebody wasn't in a good mood. He said, you can't always assume that it's because you're awful. And I think once, as a writer, I don't know for you, but for me, once I reframe it that way, I'm just kind of like, okay, move on. Somebody will take it. You know, and he also said before the days of simultaneous submissions, you know, now everybody says it's fine to send, you know, to send your one piece to 40 places at once. Back then it wasn't really done. You know, you were expected
to just do one at a time.
Yep, you had to do one at a time and then wait 6 months, a year, and you'd have to go to your mailbox to check, you know, to see if you got it back or whatever. And, of course, all he always used to say to me, because it was before the days of electronics and email and all this, he used to say, well, how the heck do they know if you send it to other places, too? He say, just do it. Worry about it later.
I'm incredibly boring and good and always only sent it out one at a time, but there you go.
Yeah, exactly.
He was quite right, though.
Yeah, to just do it. So I think that's really interesting, because I also think that based on how you react to rejection is how well you keep going. You know, I do think that some people just get so defeated and they just don't go any further, and I think that's sad. So,
I'd agree with that. I'm talking to various people, you know, and they go, oh, isn't it wonderful that you've got a book out? Yeah, I tried to write a book, and you go, oh, yeah, yeah. And I say, yeah, no, I had so many rejections I just gave up. And you say, well, how many rejections do you have? Oh, I had at least six. And then they gave up, and you think, oh, six would have been nice. I could have done a lot more.
And I'm like, yeah, would you like to come over and look at my files that go all the way back to 1983 and see the 603 that I have?
Absolutely. So, yes, I think you're right. Some people, you work through, perhaps it is the old kind of Nietzschean philosophy, that which doesn't kind of kill me makes me stronger. But you work through it and you just keep going. But, there you go, the joy of being a writer.
Yes, but it's rewarding, too. Do you feel like the creative process is like a spiritual connection for you at all? Because I guess I'm asking because, you know, this book, like I said, this book really blew me away. It's just very spiritual. It's very dark. It's very beautifully written. It has so many things to say on so many levels, which is so nice because a lot of times that doesn't happen with every book you read. You know, sometimes it's just a surface thing and you're done. Was this really a journey for you writing this, or can you tell us a little bit about your experience with that?
That's an interesting one. I probably wouldn't use the word spiritual, probably because I don't regard myself as a particularly spiritual person. But certainly it was a multi-layer journey. I found it very rewarding at various levels in terms of writing. And indeed, I don't want to say it because sometimes people say, do you prefer writing prose or poetry? And I don't have a preference. Mm-hmm. But there is a different experience in writing a fully-fledged poem that breathes compared to writing a short story, say. and I found the satisfaction of writing the novel probably more akin to writing poetry. So you do get the various levels of resonance, the intellectual, the emotional, the gut, the bit of the brain that's not tied down to anything physical. So yes, it was a journey. I just probably personally wouldn't use the word spiritual, but that's a personal preference.
And you had said you're working on some things now, so would you like to talk a little bit about what you're working on, what you have coming up? And I understand if you don't want to talk about subject matter of what you're working on, because I, as a writer, never talk about the subject matter until it's actually out of my head, because otherwise, for some reason, it never makes it to the page.
Yes, so be careful. As I said, obviously, I continue to write poetry and short stories, so a number of things there on the go. In terms of the novel, number two, it's still a fantasy theme, but not as dark as A Darker Moon. I mean, it's got some dark elements to it, but it's probably more pure fantasy, less looking at the human psyche, more working with the story, and it's a combination of a fantasy and a little bit of woman's fiction in there as well. So it's going to be lighter than A Darker Moon, but then A Darker Moon does get quite dark in certain places, so I don't think I'd want to get much darker than that, at least not for the time being.
Right.
I'm trying to think what else I can say about it. I think that'd be a favourite. It's definitely fantasy. And again, it's moving away from myth and looking more, I suppose, a more traditional fantasy creation, the world of witches and witchcraft. Beyond that, I said, possibly don't want to go to too much detail, as you say, if you kind of let go. Well, having said it, the story's basically written. It's now at the editing stage, and I suppose there are some themes. It plays with the discovery of the past and the discovery of family ties. So now I come to think of it, there probably are one or two links between that and A Darker Moon, which is mainly when you start thinking about it, but there you go.
How close are you to being done with the second project? Like, done, I mean, in terms of first draft, ready to send out, or polishing, or working it through critique, or where are you at right now with it?
Right, I am pretty close, I hope, to sending it out. It's been through more than one draft.
Okay.
And it's just been one of those periods where you have to do, you let it lie fallow and just kind of back away with it for a bit, and I'm ready to go back to it and have another look and say, is it there? It may even be complete. Or do I need to do any further work to it? So we're at that stage. It may be complete and I haven't realised, or I may go back to it and go, ooh, I need to do some more major rewrites.
The story's there.
It's a complete whole.
I think some stories or novels or books or poems or whatever go through several drafts. I know for me with Bad Apple, it was 2 years in the final editing process with Vagabondage, which was great. I mean, I had Nanette as an editor, Nanette Morges, and she's an amazing editor. But it was a long process. And I think some people don't realize that books can often go through so many drafts. Like, and then there's that point where you're like, oh, my God, I can't look at this anymore. I'm just like, I'm done.
Yes, well, somebody once told me that's how you know when you need to stop editing, because I am a compulsive editor of my own work. I mean, you do it with poetry because you're always refining it and tightening it. And can you make it better? Do it with my short stories. Did it with a novel. And I can remember reading somewhere, someone said, well, how do you know when you finished editing? And the answer to that was, well, basically, you've never really finished editing, but either when you get to the stage and you pick the manuscript up and you either burst into tears or you end up throwing it at the wall and can't bear to pick it up, you know you've got to the end of the editing process.
Running for the nearest bottle of alcohol just thinking about picking it up again.
That works for me as well, I have to say. Yes, I have no problem thinking about it.
Well, it has been a delight having you on the show, JS, and thank you so much for staying up so late over there across the ocean to talk with us. Can you give out your website and your Facebook page so our listeners know where to reach out to you personally if they'd like to connect with you?
I can indeed, because I'd love to connect them if they've liked what they've heard so far. It'd be great to hear from them. My website is www.jswatts.co.uk. My Facebook page, I must admit I can't remember the exact address, but you'll find me under JS Watts. I don't think there are too many JS Watts on Facebook, so put that into the search engine and I'm bound to crop up. And it would be great to hear from people, particularly if they've heard the show. It would be lovely to hear what they think, because I've really enjoyed being on, and thank you so much for having me. And I have to say, one of the things that always worries me slightly is hearing other people read my own work, and it was brilliant. I really enjoyed listening to your reading, so thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. It was just a privilege to read it, and I'm sure it's one of those books I'll be reading a second time, and, you know, again, that's rare for me, but it's just such a beautiful piece of work. It's got so much to say about memory and identity and the search for self, and, you know, all in this wonderful, like, wrapped up, I don't want to use something silly like egg roll, but that's the only thing I can think of, in this really cool story that's really kind of scary, really on the edge, really mystical, and just quite a ride. So, I thank you. We're just about out of time, folks. I'd like to thank, again, J.S. Watts for joining us tonight. And if you would like to pick up A Darker Moon or any of her other books, her poetry, just visit the Scary Scribes website, guest books, and links page. And I would like to let all our listeners know that the Scary Scribes website is not going away. It is going to be there for as long as I can keep it up. So it will always be there, which means all of our 13 episodes will be there for you to listen to, download, do whatever you like with. I cannot say that Scary Scribes is gone forever. We may come back sometime in the future. And anyway, that wraps up our final episode of Scary Scribes. I would really like to thank all of our prior guests, and especially our listeners and our fans. You guys have really made the show. We've been a big hit, which was such a nice surprise, and it's been a pleasure reading for you over this past year or so, and it's been a very rewarding experience, a very rich experience for me that I will never forget. I'm Christy Peterson Schoonover, signing off, and until next time, here's to sleeping with the lights on.
You've been listening to Scary Scribes on the Paranormal A Radio Network. You can follow us at ScaryScribes.com or www.facebook.com/ScaryScribes. Join us next time, and until then, remember, you don't have to be afraid of the dark. You have to be afraid of what's watching you in the dark.